This is Time Signatures with Jim Irvin, a podcast and radio program presented by the Capital Area Blues Society in Lansing, Michigan. Most any contemporary musical style can trace its roots back to the blues. Time Signatures explores the blues and its musical connections with captivating interviews, lively discussions, and news from the world of the blues.
You know I'm crying, crying, baby, driving up and down these Michigan roads, yeah.
And now, here he is, your host, Jim Irvin.
Well, thank you so much, Parker, and welcome to Time Signatures. I'm your host, Jim Irvin. And seldom is the time that you'll hear me utter the words, my guest today truly needs no introduction. But today is one of those days. If you're a fan of the mid-70s pop and rock scene, I would bet serious money that you know at least one of this guy's songs. And if you're a blues fan today, well, pretty much the same thing. Ladies and gentlemen, it gives me great pride to welcome our guest, the legendary blues man, Elvin Bishop. Elvin, thank you so much for your time and for joining me today on Time Signatures. Welcome.
Glad to be with you.
Well, I'm glad to have you, sir. And we've got a lot of ground to cover here. So let me start the ball rolling. I'd like you to talk about your earliest memories of music.
I grew up on a farm in Iowa, and we lived on a dirt road. We had an outhouse. No running water, no electricity, and we had a radio that had a battery, a huge battery. I think it was like about six-sided or eight-sided or something like that. Nothing modern about it, and it would work when the weather was right. And my folks were into the old style of music that was happening then, you know. Mm-hmm. And I didn't pay too much attention to it. Then we moved to Tulsa, Oklahoma, and when I was a young teenager, maybe about the mid-50s, got into rock and roll, and I liked Chuck Berry and Fats Domino and Elvis and all that. And then I fooled around and found out where all this stuff was coming from, blues.
Yes, sir.
And that's when I lost my mind and got really into music.
Did you have any favorite songs or artists that you just wanted to hear more and more of in those early years?
Yeah, I liked Little Richard a whole lot.
Okay.
A lot better than my folks did.
I can imagine. Now, you talked about the blues. Let's talk about the baptism, man. Where did that start for you, and how long did it take you to get fully immersed in the genre?
It took about 30 seconds. I used to have this big old radio, which was a huge thing, about this tall, combination radio and record player. It was, in those days, you know, it was more like a piece of furniture than a convenient little way to listen to music, you know.
Right.
I had a little hobby. I would listen to all the, see how many different stations I could get. And after midnight in Tulsa, Oklahoma, all the local stuff shut down. And then the 50,000 watts from different places across the country would come in. And one night I was fooling around and I got WLAC in Nashville.
Oh, wow.
And I heard Jimmy Reed doing Honest I Do. I don't know what year it was, but, you know, the static was crackling and the tubes were glowing. I wasn't supposed to be up that late at night, you know. And, that harmonica came cutting through, you know, so soulful and everything. And I said, oh, man, that's it. I'm gone.
Now, on the heels of that awakening, Elvin, you ended up traveling to Chicago. I want to talk about that trip just a little bit. What year was it? How old were you? And what caused you to make that trip in the first place?
I wasn't a very good student, but I was a good test taker. And I won this National Merit Scholarship, which was, you know, a big deal at the time.
Sure.
And I could go basically anywhere I wanted to. And I said, I want to go to Chicago because I knew that's where blues was.
Right.
Because all the heavy classic blues guys were alive and well then in Chicago, Muddy and Wolf and all those people, you know, Otis Rush and all of them. So I ended up going there. I didn't know whether to go to University of Chicago or Northwestern. Those are the only two universities that I knew of that were in Chicago. Just by a hell of a big piece of good luck that I ended up going to the University of Chicago, because it was located in this place called Hyde Park, which is a little island in the middle of the South Side ghetto, you know? And man, within a week or two, I was down at Pepper's Lounge at 43rd and Vincennes, listening to this band, and it was Muddy Waters, Otis Spann, Willie Big Eye Smith, and a bass player, and Pat Hare, a great guitar player. And I just said, oh man, I had made friends with all the black dudes that worked in the cafeteria, and they were all blues fans. And they'd take me down there, and I said, man, these blues bands are great, you know? I thought they were all gonna be like that. But I got to hear a lot of great, you know, gradually got into the scene in Chicago, and it was really cool.
Well, I caught one of your interviews, and you talked about being in Chicago your first or second day, and you stumbled upon a significant part of Chicago's blues scene, another legend, Paul Butterfield. I have to hear this story from you.
Oh, you just told it. I was walking around the neighborhood around the university just to see what was going on, and I seen this guy. It was a white guy drinking a quart of beer and playing blues on a guitar, sitting on some steps, you know, in front of an apartment building. I said, well, this has got to be my type of guy. I went over and made friends with him and started up talking. It was Butterfield. He didn't even play harmonica yet. At some point, he picked up the harmonica, and within about 6 months, he just became great. He was a natural genius on the instrument, you know.
Now, how long after you met Paul did you actually become part of the Paul Butterfield Blues Band? And that had to be an incredibly heady time playing with Butterfield, Bloomfield, Sam Lay, and the rest, yeah?
Well, we covered a lot of ground that hadn't been explored before, I'll tell you that. It was about 3 or 4 years. I played with a lot of different bands before I got with Butterfield. It was like I was on fire for the music, so I was just practicing 24 hours a day and out jamming, and I played in all kinds of bands. We had this one band called the Southside Olympic Blues Team. That was whoever we could round up if somebody got a gig, you know. And the Salt and Pepper Shakers. And I played with some of the old classic Chicago guys, even before what we consider Chicago blues now. J.T. Brown's a saxophone player.
Wow.
And did gigs with a lot of the guys, you know. Chicago was like a big school for learning blues, because you played from 9 o'clock in the evening till 4 in the morning.
Wow.
45 on, 15 off. And that's a lot of time. And even the biggest stars like Muddy or anyone are glad about 2 o'clock in the morning to see somebody coming to eat up some of that time for them, you know. And that made it good for young musicians, because if you're serious about the music and you knew that these jamming opportunities were going to be happening all over the city, you would sit and learn some of these guys' tunes so you could make a good showing, you know, because it was...
Yes, sir.
It was kind of like a half-ass employment agency, you know. And man, things were just popping.
Now, you talked about, you know, rubbing elbows with some of the greats, Hound Dog Taylor, Otis Rush, Muddy, Magic Sam, just to name a few. Any memorable moments that you want to share from those early days?
Well, I remember the first time I saw Magic Sam. He was playing in a big place, a dance hall type of place, you know. And I was about 17 at the time. And I look back and I say, man, I was pretty fearless in those days. And, you know, because I was the only white guy in the crowd most of the time, you know. And I went in and went back in the back room and introduced myself to Magic Sam, and he was real nice and let me hang around the dressing room and everything, you know. But then the cop, he said, "How old are you?" And I said, 21. He said, "Let me see your ID." He kicked me out. So I went out the back and I went around, came in the front door again. About the third time, he finally said, "Well, okay, you can stay, but don't start up no shit, you know."
Yeah. You eventually broke out on your own. In 1975, you released the album Strutting My Stuff. Now, I'm assuming that you have some good exposure from the album. And then lightning struck in 1976 with the release of a single you referred to as an accident of sorts. An accident, by the way, that resulted in making Elvin Bishop truly a household name. How about some details on that one?
You're talking about Fooled Around and Fell in Love.
Yes, sir.
I used to hang out with this guy in San Francisco. I've always been lucky to have real good musicians with me and great people to work with. And this guy was a good example. And this friend of mine was named Gideon Daniels, and he was the son of a preacher. His dream was to have sort of a rainbow type of gospel group, you know? He had like a Japanese singer and a Filipino guy and a white guy playing piano and like that, you know? And he'd go through the South and make trips through the South and look for good singers, you know?
Oh, wow.
And he came to Cairo, Georgia, and he found this guy named Mickey Thomas. And he liked him, he hired him, brought him to San Francisco. And we got to hanging out together, and at some point he joined my band. He was a great singer, is a great singer still.
Absolutely.
Yeah, he's still got that young sounding voice. It's amazing, he hasn't lost a thing. So we were doing a record in Miami. It was produced by this guy, Simzik, Bill Simzik.
Okay.
He's the guy that produced my one and only hit and also B.B. King's one and only hit.
Wow.
He also produced Thrill Is Gone. And we had, I think, maybe 11 tunes cut, and they were all pretty good. And he said, "We need one more to fill things out, the time, you know." He said, "What do you got laying around?" And I said, "What about this tune right here?" It's a tune that I'd tried to get three or four other singers to sing with me, but nobody seemed to care much about it. So we cut a track, and it came out real good. And I went in there, and I sort of demoed it up for the producer, but my voice didn't. You're hearing my voice now. Thomas has got a voice that he can sing the phone book, you know, for you, and you'll get thrilled.
Yeah.
I said, "No, this ain't butter and the biscuit. I wonder if I could get Mickey to give it a shot." He says, "Okay." And he went and did it, and he killed it. You know, in a way, it's a manner of odds. I've written hundreds of tunes, and I tried real hard on all of them and did the best I could. And if you throw enough stuff up against the wall, something's going to stick after a while. I think that's just what happened.
Well, isn't it kind of cool that, you know, there's a lot of stories just like this out there in the music world where lightning in a bottle has been captured accidentally, as you called this an accident. It was just one of those things. It was happenstance. But it wasn't, as you have poignantly pointed out, was not just the song, it was the guy singing it that really pushed it over the top.
Yeah, you go back and listen to that record, and there's so many things that have to happen right. You know, like the piano player was on that day. Johnny V, the other guitar player, was really on. He did some really unusual stuff on it, and it all fell together just right, you know?
Yeah. As I was preparing for this interview today, I actually listened to the extended versions, I guess, and that song came on, and it takes me right back to the years, because I was 10 years old when that came out, and to hear that again with fresh ears, knowing the story and knowing who's singing it. And it's just a wonderful, it's a rite of passage, I guess, for people that were growing up in that era to know that song.
Yeah. In those days, things were set up better for new artists than they are now, because there weren't a million different streaming sources, you know,
yeah,
for music to be heard. There was basically one source, and that was the radio. And if you got in with the radio, that was it.
Yep.
So that was lucky.
Well, as we turn the page here, now more than 50 years in the business, you've become somewhat of an elder statesman in the blues, haven't you? How does that fit you, Elvin?
Elder as hell, that's right. man, you did your homework. What was
I'm trying. Well, I'm just wondering how the title elder statesman fits with you. It, you know, there's a lot of people that give you a lot of kudos and respect the hell out of you because of your body of work and the years that you've put in. How does that fit you?
Well, I've been at it for 60 some years and trying hard all that time. So I appreciate being recognized, you know.
Yes, sir. Well, are you finding that the new generation of blues artists are seeking counsel from yourself and others who have well more than paid their price for these decades?
Some of them do, yeah.
And what kind of advice do you give them when they come to you?
I don't give out too much advice. I just kind of tell them what happened to me, you know, and I wish them well. That's about it.
Okay. Now, I have to tell you, and I was stumbling over the title earlier here, Extended Versions is the album that I was referring to. And, of course, I love the work that you released with fellow bluesman Charlie Musselwhite. 100 Years of Blues is just flat-out fun, Elvin. So what's next for you? What's going on now? I know you tour a little bit.
Yeah, I just talked to Muscle this morning a little bit, and some gigs are coming in for this summer. We're doing quite a few, so it's like that, you know. The romance of travel has worn off on me, you know. I don't really enjoy that part so much, and I'm at a place now where I live in a real nice place, and I have a beautiful wife and a nice daughter, and just had my first grandkid.
Hey.
And yeah, and I don't go looking for gigs. If they call me, you know, and if it's a good deal, I'll go.
Sure,
but
sure.
I don't try to stir it up or anything. You know, I'm just as happy staying home. But I always enjoy the musical part and getting together with the people. It's just getting there and getting back is what you know.
Go ahead.
No, I wasn't going to say nothing important.
Okay. Well, it's all important, but I have to ask you, from one grandfather to another, because I just became a grandfather within the last year and a half, what's that like for you?
Oh, it's great. It's kind of a bigger thing than you would think it is. Well, you know what I'm talking about.
Yes, sir.
What a little kid, you can't beat him.
As a matter of fact, I'm gonna see my grandson tonight, and I'm also gonna see my great niece tonight because it's my nephew's birthday. But I have to tell you, something about looking at what your child created and holding them for the first time and just letting them wrap their heart around your finger. And every time I see that little boy, he is just the coolest creation I've ever seen in my life. And I never thought I could fall more in love than I did with my kids. But I did.
There you go.
Yes, sir. Well, Elvin, make no mistake, history is going to record that Elvin Bishop was among those at the forefront of the modern blues movement and helped keep it alive for future generations. Now, as we get close to the close of this interview, what advice would you like to give to the next generation? What charge can you send them away with?
I don't know. Listen to the old masters, and that'll help you get your vocabulary and your licks together. And then the world don't need another Stormy Monday, and it don't need another Got My Mojo Working. It needs something based on your experience. And that's all I can say.
Very good. And finally, where can we learn about Elvin Bishop? maybe buy some albums, some merchandise, find your tour dates, or maybe book you for a gig. And they better make it a good offer, because you don't have to.
There you go. My booking agent is the Curlin Agency, a guy named Jack Randall. He's real cool. K-U-R-L-A-N-D. It's in Boston. And I got a website. It's called Elvin Bishop Music. It used to be called Elvin Bishop, but then somebody bought that name up when I wasn't looking.
Oh, boy.
And tried to blackmail me for a bunch of money. And I said, oh, hell, just go ahead and do what you're going to do. So they changed the name of the website to bonemywife.com.
Oh, my Lord. Wow.
So it's Elvin Bishop Music now.
If we'll put that one up, we'll make sure we get it right, okay?
Yeah.
Well, Elvin Bishop, it has indeed been a pleasure and an honor to have you here today. I want to thank you so much for joining me on Time Signatures, and much continued success as you go into 2025.
Thanks a million. Appreciate it. Nice to be with you.
Well, I appreciate you too, sir. Now, before we wrap up today, please allow me to take a moment to tell you all about the Blues Archive at the University of Mississippi. Time Signatures is proud to have been accepted to the archive. In fact, we're the only currently produced podcast housed there. Now, if you happen to visit Oxford, Mississippi, you can see all sorts of great blues items, including a private collection of albums and wax cylinders that were once the property of the late B.B. King. In fact, his donation back in 1982 was a catalyst for starting the archive, which opened officially in 1984. Now, donations are welcome. We're going to put a link right here on the episode. And to learn more, please look at the information on this episode for the link, and we appreciate your time. And that concludes this episode of Time Signatures. My thanks once again to Elvin Bishop, but also to you, for without you, none of this would be possible. Jim Irvin reminding you, keeping the blues alive is everyone's responsibility, but preserving the history of the blues one story at a time, that's my mission. Until next time, so long, my friends.
This has been Time Signatures with Jim Irvin, presented by the Capital Area Blues Society in Lansing, Michigan. For more information on cabs, visit capitalareablues.org. You can find this episode and past episodes at lccconnect.org. The Time Signatures theme song, Michigan Roads, is used by permission and was written by Root Doctor, featuring Freddie Cunningham.
You know I'm crying, crying, baby, driving up in
Until next time, keep on keeping the blues alive.
Baby, I'm home.
Examining the issues and topics that affect our lives from the local level to the world stage. Listen to the programs of LCC Connect anytime at lccconnect.org.
LCC Connect. Voices. Vibes. Vision.
Academic success is a priority at Lansing Community College, and when assistance is needed, tutoring is available to all students. The LCC Tutoring Services at LCC has developed several options to work with students in their busy schedules, including WebEx tutoring sessions, math exam prep parties, and the Writing Center. Resources include quick print stations, chemistry and anatomy models, microscopes, and several other tools to help students. Tutors may also be available for pre-scheduled after-hours appointments. To find out more about tutoring services, visit lcc.edu/tutoring.
Feeling froggy? Well, leap into 20-plus podcasts at lccconnect.org.
LCC Alumni Stories, a show dedicated to highlighting the amazing alumni of Lansing Community College. I'm Steve Robinson, president of LCC, and on each episode, I have the awesome privilege of getting to know one of our many inspiring alums and hearing about their experiences at and since leaving LCC.
Listen to this program and many others on demand at lccconnect.org.
When our son and his wife had children, we thought he would settle down. We didn't know his drinking problems were just getting started. I don't know why he would choose alcohol over his beautiful family. In retirement, I thought my husband and I would enjoy going places and doing things together. Our son's drinking seriously interfered with our plans. All of a sudden, we worried about our grandchildren, and we didn't know what to do or where to go for help. Our son's attorney suggested we try Al-Anon family groups. I didn't want to go because Al-Anon met at a church, but I found out Al-Anon isn't part of any religion. Al-Anon is a spiritual program, not a religious organization. Sometimes they use meeting rooms in hospitals, churches, or schools. I'm glad we tried Al-Anon family groups right here in our community. Is someone's drinking troubling you? You might be surprised at what you can learn in an Al-Anon family group from people just like you. Call 1-888-4-ALANON or go to alanon.org.
Michigan residents age 25 or older may qualify for Michigan Reconnect, a program providing free or reduced tuition to students who have not earned a prior college degree. Reconnect students are responsible for books and fees. Visit lcc.edu/reconnect for more information.
LCC.
Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.
Hello there, this is Terry Denise, a Lansing Community College student and your host of Ripper, an LCC Connect podcast where I interview others and ask about their unique efforts and connections in, around, and beyond the community of Michigan's capital city.
Hello.
Hi. Welcome to part two of Vamp here on Ripper. I am Terry Denise. I am joined here by Brendan.
Blah.
Oh, blah.
That was my best vampire.
That was great. I liked it.
Thank you.
Do you remember our count from Sesame Street?
Yeah. One.
See, I had mentioned that my first introduction into loving vampires was probably Bram Stoker's Dracula of Francis Ford Coppola. But no, it was The Count. The Count, which was basically Bela Lugosi's Count, right? That was Bela Lugosi's Dracula, I believe.
He was probably, yeah, probably closer to that.
Did he
have glasses? Like little...
I think he had a monocle.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
It's so good. I totally forgot about that. He was, oh, wow, what a great character. And once again, I'm
super classy.
Dude, PBS is the best, dude. Sesame Street. So we are talking about vampires, more specifically Nosferatu. Now, the title of these, this is part two, so we had part one. Thank you so much for enjoying that and joining us here on part two again. So the title Vamp is the name of a movie, a vampire movie from 1986, I believe, that has Grace Jones in it. And that's also a word where people say talk. It's our airwaves broadcasting version of like, keep talking, just go with it. So I love that word in and of itself. But if you haven't seen Vamp from 1986, please check it out. Grace Jones is amazing. She wears the best costumes ever. And that woman is just, oh gosh, queen icon. Brutally so. She is also, this is just a little part. If you haven't seen, what was it with Eddie Murphy? Vampire in Brooklyn.
Right, yeah, yes, yeah.
Back in the early 90s. Boomerang. Watch Boomerang and then watch Vampire in Brooklyn. Just get your whole Grace Jones, Eddie Murphy, early 90s, late 80s thing in and you will have the best weekend ever.
That sounds great.
So Vampire in Brooklyn was really good in the best way. That movie is so colorful. It's so campy. So it has the best of the best of the exploitation era. But it also beckons back to just, you know, classic romantic style. And then it has that vibrant editing and producing in it. And then, of course, it's Eddie Murphy and a different character where you get to see him play. And he plays like a street preacher, I believe. Or not a street preacher, just like a regular general preacher. So you see him do Eddie Murphy, which is playing multiple characters in an entire film, which is crazy. That man's got, he's got to be on all kinds of just throwing things off all day long. Man is ultimate ADHD.
I think it's the flubber. The flubber probably did it.
Yeah, for sure. Nutty Professor. How many characters in that? Anyway.
Too many.
I want to see him in another vampire movie, though. We need, like, Son of Vampire of Brooklyn. Please come back. His laugh in that was very good, too. So we're going to go to a more serious tone, which was the Nosferatu, Robert Eggers' version from 2024. If you recall, we were talking about the 1922 version, which was by F.W. Murnau. And then we talked a little bit about different iterations of the vampire story from Bram Stoker's Dracula, which just comes from different ideas of this creature from beyond or from the dead, how people dealt with, I guess, people just dying in general is why these stories were created in the first place. That So people just coming back from the dead to comfort people sometimes, maybe, or to scare people. So if you had, like, the worst landlord ever, and you're like, that guy was a bloodsucker. Mm-hmm. You know, he sucked all my monies from me while he was alive. I bet anything he's sucking the blood from everybody while he's dead, too. And people would just sit in the tavern and laugh at that. That would be a thing, I'm sure. And why we got those stories.
I mean, yeah, it was, people would be worried about so many things.
They even put bells on the coffins just to make sure, I'm sure. No, that was really just because they didn't have the machines that we have now that can tell you whether you're brain dead or your heart monitor.
I wonder if that's really all it was. No, it's just their heart stopped.
Old Walter was just sleeping.
You're right.
So anyway, but old Walter was not a bloodsucker like Nosferatu. So the 2024 version, if you haven't seen it, spoilers. Spoiler alert. We're going to get into it because we're going to get into the costuming, maybe even the look of the entire film and just what it sparked in each of our imaginations to how it affected us with our love for film and just culturally how it was the timing of it. So we'll just get started with that first because it the 2024 version came out right after our shutdown of COVID. Now, in the film itself, in the story itself, there's a plague going on. Like, the plague is kind of a back end of the story.
It's almost another character.
Yeah, definitely. So the plague comes off of a ship. We see that perhaps it's, you know, just the rats. Is it just the rats that are creating the plague? But there's also this haunting figure that's going around that seems to be maybe killing everybody. But is it just the plague? Or is it just the shadow figure? Or is that in and of itself what the story is? It's just like the shadow figure, an illusion, just like a method to storytelling. Like that this vampire is actually a symbol of the plague that we're going through wartime even that we're going through. Through any terrible effect that's taking my child or my my wife and husband away from me in this time in conflict, even because the original came out in 1922, a lot of different things going on. But in 1919, we also had the Spanish flu, which was just another plague. So we get a lot of these like blood-related troubles that are going on. And in these stories, we keep seeing these telltale accounts, whether it's in a Dracula movie and whatnot. But it's just sickness and missing another person. You think of blood, you think of the heart, so you think of love then as well with the heart.
Sure, yeah. There's all sorts of things at play here that I find very interesting in the sense that, and just sticking with the idea of plague, many stories do heavily hinge on this idea that they are bringers of disease, of something that is unseen. And it often is, like you're saying, it's a shadow. Creates a sense of doubt and chaos. As I was saying, in terms of theme, it's like seeing how this theme has morphed over time, because it's like in Bram Stoker's original novelization of it, the quest of the two star-crossed lovers, or two protagonists, as you might call them, they're not necessarily the end goal for Dracula. Dracula needs to get to London to then take over the world. It's less about a romantic sense of love. And so then it's with Murnau's Nosferatu in 1922, this idea that she's the key, that our heroine is the key. And that it's this idea of maybe long lost love. And then all this leading up to, as you were saying in the last episode with Bram Stoker's Dracula, here we're like at the pinnacle of mainstream cinema. This is an auteur filmmaker who is, like I said, at the height of his power in the machine, in the industry. This is the story he's chosen. And he's not only making like a film that was definitely a 90s film. He was using, he made a crank camera.
Yeah, the crank camera.
Right. Like there's that where he's searching for her in the street.
Yeah.
Where Gary Oldman's looking for her in the street. They've created an old style, silent era crank camera. to record that sequence.
That's a crazy.
And like we were saying, you know, it being a story about love, there's Gary Oldman dripping with charisma.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yes,
you know, Mac, exactly. And then just like thinking of how that then relates to 2024 Nosferatu,
mm-hmm.
is, you know, Bram Stoker's Dracula, a very big Hollywood tentpole type of film.
Mm-hmm.
And then Nosferatu, again, another tentpole studio film, but now it's incorporating all of these elements. It transcends into being a new version of the story.
Much
that can
like
then go on.
Vampire itself.
Exactly. Exactly.
So we're 20 years in the making for his screenplay of this version. He finally got it to film. So with Coppola's version, he, like you were just saying, encompassing all of these old elements of film, just the use of the, like, little models and then filming against another screen behind that. If you look in the behind the scenes, you'll see how they've made all of these things and what you were referring to with the crank camera. Those elements and just making the huge nod to everything that came before you as much as possible. With it's not just the Dracula stories, but the Nosferatu, but everything else, anything to do with vampire tales and whatnot. And bringing those elements to scream, even just with the brides, because there wasn't a lot to do with the brides ever until like a lot of the Hammer films brought that in, and some of the classic as well. But
you're right.
A lot of the Hammer films had a lot of the brides in it. A lot of nudity, a lot of gore, and a lot of fake blood everywhere, but a lot of big hair and big everywhere.
That's what I was thinking last episode, was how you're saying, you know, we get into the 70s with the exploitation and, you know, Hammer horror. And again, just a good example of how the movies are really a good expression of the times they were made in.
Yeah. And then, so there's a lot of these, the horrific elements that come through in play that, especially Coppola with his version, borrowed from and made that heavy, once again, nod to. Then we see Eggers doing that, as well as incorporating Coppola in there as well, because you can feel the Coppola. You can feel the Coppola. What is that?
That rolls off the tongue.
You could totally feel, though, some of this essence and flavor that Eggers was just like, I also too nod to you. Thank you so much, Francis. And then also on backwards with what he did, as well as emerging as this new director with a new eye, a new vision for the story. This weird love story, this predatory love story, this controversial love story. It's such a weird thing because Bill Skarsgård's version of Count Orlok, the monster in this film, is probably one of the creepiest ones I've ever seen. Gary Oldman's version is very, like you said, he is scary in that film, but he's dramatic in that film as well. But he's got, you know, like you said, the charisma.
But they make him a point. Yeah, they make him a point to be sexy, and like he's got that smooth skin and that long hair and those cool little sunglasses. Like
with the whole Victorian era.
Right.
So with this version, we see, like, he's gross.
Yes.
He's not Max Schreck. He still has that haunting feel of Schreck, but this is different. This is like, I'm going to scare you no matter what. I don't care. Mm-hmm. You see the different versions of me, and there's, like, weird half hair. So it's the Cossack look, which was just a group of area. There's a bunch of soldiers. So again, bringing that element of like PTSD veteran, but mixed in with this like super creepy vibe of like a predatory entity that comes from beyond, who originally is answering our young female protagonist when she's a child. He's answering her, calling out into the darkness to just get some comfort. And like, when we're younger, very like, I wish upon a star. I wish upon this light moon up here. And then the horrifying things is that it answers.
Well,
it answers. That's terrifying.
I mean, if you stare at the abyss long enough, the abyss will stare back.
Well, was it an angel, though? Maybe she thought it was an angel. Mm. And it was like, my angel's coming to get me and save me. And then, of course, she forgets because she's Because this is a thing that you're, she was what, like 8 years old or something? Like nine? Sure. And then all of a sudden, this creature's like, I have come to collect on your prayer that you put through when you were a child. And it's like, I was a child, you weirdo. Mm. What's wrong with you? And so, like, as you say, as in the original Nosferatu as well, where our main character, Ellen, she's the one that has to, she puts herself out there to go like, oh, well, I guess I did want that. Maybe. I don't know. And she herself puts herself into, we see this in the Francis Ford as well with Winona Ryder at the very end, her Mina, giving herself over to, she's the one that actually ends Dracula's life at the very end of that particular film. She's the one that's just like, no, like I know you. I've fallen in love with you. I've fallen in love with who you thought I was, like your previous princess that we were supposed to get married and whatnot and have our or finish out our marriage together and live our lives. So she too, in that instance, is just like, I'm going to do the thing that nobody else here can give you. And that is, like you said, be the light to your darkness, which is what you are craving. You want this ending.
It's really what love is.
Yeah.
It's just taking the time. I see someone else has some darkness. I wonder if a little light might help.
Oh, that's very sweet.
Well, that's also what I took from the 2024 version of Nosferatu, is this almost bittersweetness at the end of the film of, I won't go so far as to say love conquers all, but tying back that theme of plague and how this film seems to embody, you know, much like our modern culture, like the modern zeitgeist of mental health, and not only mental health, but the view of self as it's viewed through others. Mm-hmm. We're very focused on there should be a space for mental health.
Yeah.
You know, only you will know how you feel. Mm-hmm. So if you're not up to it, you're the only one that can know that. Mm-hmm. But then with that in mind, knowing that maybe other people are going through things.
Yep.
So it's, again, just making space for them so that they can just be know that it's okay to be okay.
Yeah.
Like you're allowed, there's a space to feel the way you feel. So you're allowed to recognize that feeling and not worry about the weight of it.
And yeah, so to say that within the end of the Nosferatu 2024 version, we do see that, and the 1922 version as well does that, where our character Ellen, she encompasses and embraces the darkness to then, I guess you could say, offset this hearkening creature that has come over and literally has plagued everybody else's lives around them because it is missing this element that could put it to rest and basically neutralize it.
Mm. See, I wonder if Orlok wanted that to happen.
From the get.
There's a very moment at the end as he's drinking her blood.
Yeah.
And she looks and sees the sun coming up and she's like, okay, this is the moment.
Yeah.
He looks up and recognizes what he sees what's going on. Mm-hmm. And he just goes back to drinking her blood. And on one hand, you could easily say it's the, you know, it's insatiable hunger and he's a vampire. It's a grand metaphor.
Parasitic.
Exactly.
It's only doing what it's going to do in that moment.
Well, sure, but
also like a baby. Sure. It's very infant-like in that sense where like.
Then he's complete though. He's right where he should be.
That's
not
the mother.
That's not wrong or bad or othered.
The framing of that also visually is very much so that it's a very, not virgin mother, but it is kind of the virgin mother.
It's like a temple.
It is.
It's a very sacred moment.
Yeah.
Between them.
It's very like, it looks like almost a tarot card even.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it looks, so at the end we see a lot of floral displays, which is a theme throughout the film where Ellen is getting all of these flowers from her husband and from Hutter. And at some point in time, we keep seeing the flowers keep dying all of a sudden, which is an allusion to this vampire creature coming along and basically killing everything from where it enters. So its trail leaves behind nothing but death, basically, and we see that in the flowers. But in the end, we see nothing but bouquets falling on their bodies, which end up being together, her being dying with the creature of Orlok as we see them. Interesting, too, with another theme with time that plays into this, because at the beginning of the film, we see Hutter and Ellen, and Hutter's late to work. So, and it's almost kind of like this thing with, I don't know if it's a funny stereotype or whatever, but there's a thing with Germans and their time. And then it's like being very on time is the best thing you could probably be, especially for work and what.
On time is 5 minutes too late.
Exactly. There you go. So we see Hutter, and he's a newlywed with Ellen, and he is late because they're newlyweds, and they've been up all night and up all morning doing things, as newlyweds do. So we see him going to work late, and they're just like, oh, you are late for your appointment, and don't let this happen again. They basically kind of give him a forewarning, but in a very nice way, because they're like, okay, you got a new wife, we get it. But at the ending, we see Hutter, and he is racing literally against time and the sun try to save his wife, because he's got a different plan than for her to become the martyr, which is another one of these things, a theme about being a martyr, about giving yourself to death to spare lives, or to maybe take lives. I don't know, which is what the vampire does, is he gave himself to, he made a pact. And so we get into very super crazy zones there, where there's a lot of dark arts at play. There's a lot of symbols and sigils, and you see that in the original Nosferatu as well. But in this version, it gets heavy into there, where it's really, really dark and heavy at points in time, where you see the Hutter's.
He's like kind of like the Renfield character. He's the one that goes mad.
Yes. He's playing too much with candles. All those fumes are destroying the brain cells. But yeah, he gets in there, and boy, oh boy, we go also into the village, and there's nothing but destruction there. You see all of this, like, where people keep giving themselves to, they let Hutter into their village when Hutter goes on the trek to find the Count. And he goes through a village, and those people there are like, I don't know if you want to do too much here or there or whatnot, and we're going to be laughing at you because you are silly to go seek this out. We're going to tell you what's going on. So we're like, well, okay, fine. We'll let you into our village. We'll let you know what's in the know. And then they end up dying because they let this person in, almost, you know. It's almost like they engage with too much. They let too much in. There's a lot of giving oneself to the notion of love, to being a martyr. And yeah, we definitely see that all through. This particular film makes it effortless and beautiful. So with that allusion to a lot of what you see with even just the religious aspect of, like, the Abrahamic religious aspect, so you can pull in the Virgin Mary as she's looking upon her child as he's dying, as the Christ, as she holds the Christ, and he's like, it's nothing but the blood that's spilling. There's nothing but these tales of blood encountering over and over again in a lot of these themes. This is a great place to stop, because it looks like we're going to have a part three.
We're probably going to have a part three.
All right. This is Terry Denise and Brendan.
Yeah.
On Ripper. We'll be right back with part three.
See you soon.
On another day. Thank you. Thanks for tuning in to Ripper. You can find more about this and other LCC Connect podcasts at lccconnect.com.
This has been a presentation of LCC Connect, a weekly program that features the voices, vibes, and vision of Lansing Community College. All shows featured on LCC Connect are recorded at the WLNZ studio, located on LCC's downtown campus. Each program is podcast-based and can be heard anytime at lccconnect.org. If you or someone you know would like to be a guest on one of our shows, connect with us by emailing lcc-connect@lcc.edu.